So, welcome everyone to the start of a new theme. And the theme is the 7-point mind trainings. I thought I would begin by just rejoicing in the merits of my Thursday morning study group, really. Erica's here, and Natalie's here, Justine's here, and Acompia's here. Jeff's the only one missing from that group. And we've been meeting for 4 years now, I think. What? Yeah, it does, yeah. And we meet every Thursday morning at 6:30 in the morning. And we do Dharma study, and we pick a theme. We used to meditate at like around 7:30 to 8, but what we found was we would get so excited about the material we were studying that the meditation started to kind of get pushed back. But then also people are very excited about the meditation, so frequently they still stay and meditate in addition, you know, after we end. But I've really enjoyed that group. I think I like the level of commitment that's created by studying at 6:30 in the morning. You've got to be committed to do that. Coffee helps me, yeah. Yeah, definitely coffee helps me. And I think also that regularity of kind of being with one another on Thursday mornings, you really start to develop friendships. And I think people would have got that in other ways, the center too. Like just to have like a study group you meet with every day or once a week for, you know, a year, taking a topic deeper, you start to get a sense of other people and you start to get a feeling of trust for other people and you start to get a sense of how they communicate themselves. And it allows for a real depth to start to develop, which is very valuable when it comes to Dharma study. And also personal transformation. And I think I'll talk a little bit later about the history of the 7-point mind training, but it was started in Tibet very much along the lines of Atisha was kind of the founder of the 7-point mind training, and he basically was just teaching. He was teaching people, and he probably had small groups like that of kind of, you know, yeah, I don't know. This is my imagination because I have no idea. But, you know, they would have been at a monastery and they would have had to have had groups of maybe, you know, 10 or 15 monks come to him and he might be teaching them. And he starts to learn what the monks are like and he's got a familiarity with life in the monastery anyways. And he starts coming up with ways for these monks to actually train their mind. You know, he knows what he's aiming for. He's got the Buddha's teachings. He's got other people's expressions of the Dharma. But he wants to apply it to these actual monks that are in front of him. He wants to make something that's very practical and very alive in the moment for them. Yeah? And so he comes up with these sort of lists of points a bit that they can practice. And the 7-point mind training, it said that there were lots of different notes for the mind training notes. So different people had different sets of notes. Different people pulled different things out of what he said. But in the end, it sort of crystallized into a particular formulation, which just came out of somebody's sets of notes. Because you can imagine that those notes were sort of particularly good, let's say. You know, or they were particularly clear. And then people started saying, oh, look, could I get your notes? You know? And it just kind of circulated and became a text. Yeah? But I like that idea of a more human context for it and it kind of growing out of human relationships. So, the 7-point mind training, the first thing I'd like to talk about, or first thing I'd like to say about it, is to give a bit of a caveat. Because I think that the fact that we said that it's Tibetan, and I think the fact that you've probably, most of you have never kind of had any exposure to it before, makes it slightly exotic, slightly new and exciting, and therefore something you kind of think, oh, I wonder if this will be the path to enlightenment in a way. Yeah. But I want to warn you that there's nothing new here. Yeah, there's nothing new here that you would not have gotten if you had explored deep enough the Pali Canon. You know, if you just go back to the Buddha's original words, you'll find all this stuff there, but in a different form. Yeah? And I think that's a really, really good point to remember. I was looking at another book, and I ran across this kind of quote from T.S. Eliot. And it says, "We shall not cease from exploration. In the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Now, I think one of the things about Dharma training is that actually as you start to go into Dharma training and you understand more deeply where it's leading, you do realize you weren't going anywhere. You do realize that your whole journey brought you right back to where you started. You know, that the basic principles of Dharma practice, they were there in the beginning. Yeah? But I guess the virtue of exploring is getting different perspectives. There's a saying that Sangharakshita has, who's the founder of our movement, and he says, "There are no higher truths, only deeper understandings." Yeah? And so if we're looking for higher truths, if we're looking for that higher teaching, I think that can be a bit of a detour. Yep. In fact, what we want to realize is that all these things point to the same thing. So, what are they pointing at? All of these teachings are really pointing at this primacy of going for refuge. The primacy of going for refuge. And that's one of the main insights that Sangharakshita had, was that he looked at all the different Buddhist traditions and he said, well, what is the, I guess he didn't really say, or maybe you could say he saw, but what does unify them? What do all the different Buddhist traditions have in common? You know, what's the similarity between Zen Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism, and Tibetan Buddhism and Theravadan Buddhism, and Theravadan Buddhism and, you know, the Buddhism we might find in China in Pure Land schools? And what he felt was it was going for refuge was the unifying factor. And the going for refuge is really, in case you're unfamiliar with that notion, although I know a lot of you will be, is going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Buddha is a symbol of enlightenment. The Dharma is the practices leading to enlightenment. And the Sangha is the community that's following the practices leading to enlightenment. So they share that common value. They share that common goal. So that is what all of Buddhism has in common. And you can find that going for refuge. You can find the ideal, you can find the practices, and you can find the community in the seven-point mind training. Yep. So when it comes to where these dharmas are pointing to, I was going to copy all the mind training precepts and do a photocopy of it. So you'll have to wait till tomorrow, next week to get that. So I'll give you a reason to come back. But I don't know, there's about 60 points or so. How many are there? 59 points. But one of them, point 19, is that all dharma has a single purpose. So when it comes to the single purpose of the dharma, I thought I would kind of explore that. So I don't. Some of you will have seen this before too, but I really liked it when I first saw it. So when you think of your experience right now, what are the different components that make it up?
Thoughts.
What?
Thoughts.
Thoughts, yep.
Feelings.
Yep.
Sensation.
What was that one?
Environment.
Yep.
Situation.
Yep. Can I put that in environment, or is that different?
That's different.
It's different. Yep. Give me a couple more.
Perception.
Okay. Okay, well, awareness. Okay, so we've got a few up there, and you could probably fill in a few more. You might kind of bunch some of these together or pull some apart or whatever. But what basically happens, or this is what I'm going to suggest happens, is that let's say you come into the room tonight, yeah? You come into the room, so you come in here, and you experience it as cold. It's a sensation. And then you think, why didn't somebody turn on the heater? Yeah? And then you think, or then you have a feeling, it's not pleasant. Yeah? And then there might be a view, oh, kind of those people at the Buddhist center, they're just kind of so disorganized, aren't they? Yeah? And then you sort of like, remember the last time that happened? Yeah? And then you see Ratnavia with a cup of tea, and then you think, oh, he's lazy. Yeah? But then you might broaden out to a greater awareness. You might have another thought about Ratnavia. You know, and basically, it goes like this. Yeah? Yep. Just goes back like that. That's what you do. Now, that happens for all of us. But I think what happens when you're trying to practice the Dharma is that we actually believe that there's something here. Yeah? And in a way, that's us, isn't it? We believe that kind of that bouncing around actually is us. We think that we exist through that interaction of all that stuff. But in reality, yeah, and what happens if you're enlightened is that you don't make that assumption. And there's clarity in there. There's still the interaction, but you don't assume that there's anything substantial within that. So when it comes to all dharmas having a single purpose, the purpose is to get rid of this false view that we're somehow independent in the middle of it and substantial. You know, stop identifying with our feelings, stop identifying with our thoughts, and with the situation, stop clinging to some, avoiding others, and just sort of relaxing all of that. So we normally use the compass of substantiality and abiding. We think that there's a substantial self, an abiding self, that it really exists. And in fact, we make that assumption about everything around us, too. We assume that everything around us also has that abiding self. And then we just sort of try to cling, try to hold on to what brings us pleasure, and we try and push away what kind of doesn't bring us pleasure. But in some ways, the world doesn't change. It's sort of like all that still goes on. But what happens is we sort of change our response to it. We change how we are in the middle of it. And I was thinking of the Zen saying of before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. So in some ways, you're still chopping wood and carrying water. And if you think that you're trying to go somewhere else, you know, or get somewhere else, you're probably going to be disappointed. And the reason I bring this up is because I think the 7-point mind training is not a higher truth. You know, it's not, it's just the same truth, just from a different perspective. So as we talk about it, just try to remember that. All right, so I talked about how the 7-point mind training was first taught by Atisha. Atisha actually chose to come to Tibet knowing that it would reduce his life. The story behind it is that he had a couple of different options, and he was told that if he does go to Tibet to teach, you know, that it would be very beneficial, but it would reduce his lifespan by 7 years or something like that. But he chose to come anyways. And he was a very successful teacher. And he did come up with these series of aphorisms, are one of the things that came out of his teaching. I think he had other teachings too, but this is one of them. And in the mind point trainings, which are literally just bullet points almost, they're points. And I'll kind of give a summary of them all at the end. But each of those bullet points, they're all really pithy. So, and one of them is a bullet point kind of saying the importance of training in pithy sayings. Yeah? So it's point 9. So there's a couple different varieties. In all your activities, train with these words. In all your activities, train with sayings, or use sayings to train in all activities. But basically, the message there, and I think one of the virtues of the 7-point mind training, is that as we're reading it, some of the things really, really jump out at us. They sort of have a personal meaning for us. They seem to apply particularly to our lives. And since they're just a sentence, we can more easily remember them. So, say, for example, one of them, point 32, is don't lie in ambush. And, I think that's a really good one. You know, I don't know if anybody here can empathize with that idea of lying in ambush. But there are the times when you're just like looking for a fight, aren't you? You know, you're looking for a fight and you're waiting for that person to trip so that you can kind of jump on them, you know, bash their head over or whatnot. So don't lie in ambush. It's a very simple, pithy saying, but it can be very powerful for us. Particularly if it resonates with you. It might or it might not. It's not really, you know, if you don't find this one to be kind of helpful, you might find another one to be helpful. So we're all very different. We've all got this root poison, yeah, that we all think we're substantial abiding, and we either think we're junk, we're completely broken and not worthy, or we think we're really great, usually. One or the other. So, and we're neither. We're back and forth. Yeah, we're back and forth. That's the delusion sort. Yeah. So if you think you're it could be both ones. But another one of the points, point 59, is don't expect a standing ovation. Yeah? Don't expect a standing ovation. Which is pretty good, isn't it? You know, it's just like, yeah. You know, don't in a way expect the world to recognize you at all. You know, when you're good, you know, when you've kind of been generous and you've given that thing that's really hard to give, and the person says, "Oh yeah, thanks," and that's it. Or something really hard, and you do it, and the world just kind of just keeps going. It just keeps going. But don't expect the world to give you a standing ovation. So both of those are quite good. And I think they're very practical. They're very everyday. Yeah? So a couple others of them is point 4 is let even the antidote liberate itself. Now, I'm picking 2 that I think are more inspiring. So I think one of the things about pithy sayings is they can be practical, but I also think they can be inspiring. And I like that let even the antidote liberate itself, I find inspiring, because Dharma practice, in a certain way, like some people get in a twist about Like, if I practice generosity and I'm generous, well, then isn't that selfish? Yeah? Because I'm being generous, aren't I? But I think if you practice generosity in the spirit that's implied, it's sort of the I behind the generosity dissolves of itself. It just drifts away. If you practice generosity, you can practice it. You can think, I am going to be generous. Don't get twisted up about the I. Don't get twisted up about the effort required to be generous and think, oh, no, I can't make an effort because then that would be selfing. It's one of the words we've come up with in our little study group. Actually, it came from Vasantra and Vijayamala. But you know, don't worry, because that I that's pointing towards generosity will just dry up. It'll dry up in the act. Yeah, and there's another one, point 40, correct all faults in one way. The one way they're talking about here is the practice of kind of taking and giving, and I'll talk a little bit about that kind of as an introduction a little later on. But correct all faults in one way, I think, is inspiring, because it means that you just have to do one practice. And granted, it's very hard. But you only have to do one practice, and it's just like, if you focus on that, it's not complex. You know, it's not rocket scientist stuff. Physics is a lot harder to learn than the Dharma. Yeah? Chemistry is harder to learn than the Dharma. You know, the Dharma is actually really straightforward. There's a saying, I've said it before, but you know, Sangharakshita, the founder of our movement, was once asked, would he rather have $1 million or enlightenment? And he actually chose $1 million because he said that enlightenment would be easier to achieve. You just sort of, you know, practice the Dharma and it happens. Whereas $1 million is a lot harder to achieve and is more kind of complex, all the conditions and what actually goes into it happening. So maybe we might have to upgrade it to 10 million these days, because there's a lot of millionaires, yeah. But I find it quite inspiring that, you know, as I've studied the Dharma, it becomes simpler and harder at the same time. It becomes harder because the ways I need to change, I'm more attached to, but it becomes simpler because I'm clearer about what needs to change. And then, I think the other thing about these pithy sayings, I thought, was that they point in the right direction. They definitely point you in the right direction. So there was, point 33 was, don't strike at the heart. Yeah? And very evocative language, but it's that classic dagger to the heart, isn't it? It's when you know someone's got a weak point, you know they've got a weakness, and you're just like in there, you know, right to the heart. And just don't do it. Just don't do it. When someone's in a point of weakness, when they're in a point of vulnerability and stuff, don't strike them down. You know, don't do it. Even if you're right, don't do it. You know, and there's something about that that's really pithy and kind of very direct and just really points at this idea of training and compassion. Yeah. All right, so those are just some examples of some of the mind training points. But I'm going to talk a little bit about the general structure of the mind training. And then also a little bit of, well, maybe I'll talk about kind of the upcoming talks first. So next week, Justine's going to give a talk, and then Natalie, and then Akampia, and then me again. And I think the next four talks are going to be about this material, but in a very personal way. What I believe, what all three of you are going to talk about, having heard a little, yeah, Compi is like, she has to wait to see what the gods reveals, the clouds part, and the sunshine comes down. But I think one of the things about the mind training is it is very personal. There's a friend of mine in Sydney named Bodhidasa who was doing this, looking into this for about a year. And he just really pulled out the things that really worked for him. It's like there's some of the points are very basic and fundamental, and they apply, you know, everybody's going to be thinking about them. But there's others that just really kind of like apply to us. You know, they really have meaning for us, and they're very effective for us. And we kind of take it with our own slant. And I also think it is really lovely to see people talk about kind of the facet that really inspires them or interests them or engages them or they find the most challenging, whatever it might be the angle in. But I think the next four talks will not necessarily, we haven't divided up the mind training precepts into like, okay, you do the first 10, you do the second 10, I'll do the next 10. You know, it's a bit more organic than that, which I think will be more interesting, to be honest. But I wanted to give you an idea of the basic structure of the whole tonight, so that you've got some idea. And there's lots of books on the mind training. You could probably find sites on it on the internet. I'm sure there's a Wikipedia site for the 7-point mind training. This is a particular book called Enlightened Courage by Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. He was a very famous Tibetan teacher. Has anybody ever heard of Matthew Ricard? Yeah, that's his teacher right here. It's a really great kind of image of Dilgo Khyentse once where he's kind of sitting, he was kind of overweight, yeah? He had a really big belly. And he's kind of sitting outside with kind of his disciples around him. And he's got this pose, he's just kind of like this with his hand. And I couldn't quite figure out what it was about, but I realized that he was actually pretending to be Manjugosha, you know? Or you could say he was doing that gesture. Manjugosha is a particular symbolic figure in Buddhism, in Tibetan Buddhism, but also in other forms of Buddhism, which symbolizes wisdom. And it's just like, and he just kind of like had that, the sword of wisdom above his head, the sword that said to cut through delusion. Yeah, and I always remember that about him. There's a really beautiful book called Journey to Enlightenment, which is a collection of Matthew Ricard's photography and also teachings from Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. It's out of print, but it's really, really good. Also, there's poems in there by Shabkar, who's a Tibetan yogi poet, a bit like Milarepa. So, and there's another book, The Practice of Lojong. And Lojong is the Tibetan word for the 7-point mind training. And this is just, it's Trelig Kabjong. And this is just one that I happen to have, somebody gave it to me as a gift once. So it's kind of a book. I use these two books. But in amongst us on Thursday morning, we've got a couple different books. There's a book by Alan Wallace. What's the title of that one, Compia? Buddhism with Attitude. And which ones do you guys have? Do you have one of those three? Or?
Has written a couple.
Yep.
Start Where You Are.
Yep, Start Where You Are by Pema Chodron.
Two of the books.
Oh, yep, yep. So if you kind of are interested in this topic, and in the next couple series kind of make you think, oh, that's, you know, pick up one of these books and read it. Pick up one of the small ones first. Pema Chodron's books are very approachable, they're very accessible. So, yeah, give it a read and see what you think. Take it a bit deeper. So the basic structure of the mind training is, first of all, in the very first point, is train in the preliminaries. So, who's been here the last couple weeks? Excellent. So you'll tell me what the preliminaries are then. The mind training. The mind turning reflections. Can anybody remember those? No, not you. You kinda, you're a ringer. You're sort of like a pool shark.
This precious life.
That's one. Yep.
And dinner?
Yep.
Defects.
What?
Defects.
Defects, yep, and karma. So, yeah, the defects of samsaras. So, when it comes to these preliminaries, in a way, what the mind training says, and a lot of Tibetan Buddhism says this, sort of like says, you know, you've got to practice a bit. You know, you've got to have an inclination towards the Dharma. You've got to have a will. You know, you've got to want to. You got to want to change something, you know. I think when I was younger and first came across the Dharma, I just had a sense that there must be more than this. I just everything that was presented to me, I thought, this can't be it. This can't be it. I mean, I grew up in America, in Ohio, so it was pretty easy to have that realization. But we probably have all had that point at some point where it's just like we kind of think, you know, what more is there? And a lot of times it comes from some experience along these lines. So the preciousness of human life is sort of, the way I've got it down here, it's just a sense of presence. It's sort of like an awareness. It's a kind of arriving to yourself. So sometimes you'll be sitting somewhere and you'll just like wake up. Yeah, you might just wake up. You have a big experience. You see things for the first time. Your awareness expands. It's like you wake up and you kind of realize the beauty of things. You realize how beautiful things are, you know. And it's not just that you see it in a mundane sort of way, like looking in a shop window and seeing something that's pretty, but it's like a real realization of the beauty, the deep beauty of things. Yeah, you realize this is a precious opportunity. You realize that you're breathing. You realize you're alive. You realize you're awake, and you value that. You think, that is damn good. Yeah? So the next one with impermanence is, I'm sure some of you have probably had an experience like that, you know, which actually can be cultivated. We can do reflections, and that's what the last 4 weeks was talking about, cultivating, reflecting on these things. You know, we don't have to wait for them to just happen. We can create conditions by which they happen more regularly. Impermanence, though, if you had a spontaneous experience of presence, which I'm sure some people have, what happens a week later? Yeah, impermanence. Things change, they shift, they move. Yeah, so you've got that experience, you know, you have that kind of amazing thing, and then it ends. Yeah, so you've got constant change. So in addition to constant change, when you sort of you realize there's change, I think the thing about karma is that karma kind of is the whole point about agency. Yeah? And by agency, I mean that there you can take responsibility. Yeah? And by responsibility, it's not a kind of a finger-wagging responsibility. Yeah? It's the opportunity to choose. You know, it's the fact that you have an opportunity to choose. So there is change, there is beauty, but you can affect that change. You can act within that change. You are not just subject to that change. There are things you can do. You can take action in the midst of that. And the defects of samsara is really, in my opinion, to guard against aiming for perfection. I don't know if this is really the right way to say it, but when I kind of came across the Dharma for the first time, I remember I remember thinking, well, if I wanted something to kind of make everything right, yeah, but in a certain way, that's not possible, you know? In a certain way, you can't perfect the world. The world stays kind of in this imperfect, ill-fitting wheel that kind of clunks along and every now and then just kind of, you know, hits you on the side of the head. Yeah, that's kind of the nature of the world. You're not going to get a perfect worldly existence out of Dharma practice. You know, the world isn't going to get perfected. Just doesn't work that way. Yeah. So I think these four are really good because the defects of samsara really in a way helps point us beyond the world in a way, beyond the mundane, beyond the senses stuff. So these are the preliminaries. This is kind of the very first point of 59. So you kind of need to cultivate the mind that turns towards the Dharma. Once you've got that, yeah, then you basically train in the bodhicitta. So bodhicitta is... there's lots of different... Remember when I was talking about this kind of this idea that going for refuge is something that's uniform across... it's kind of like a unifying factor for different schools of Buddhism. Well, a lot of different schools of Buddhism have different words where they talk about this... A turning point, in a way, that happens in our practice. And kind of... Yeah. So in Theravadan Buddhism, they talk about it stream entry, which we've talked about on Monday nights before. There's the arising of the bodhicitta. There's going for refuge. And there's also another one, which is turning about at the greatest seat of consciousness, which is my favorite. Yeah? That sounds cool. That's what I want to have happen. So... The arising of the bodhicitta, the training in the bodhicitta, is basically when it comes to the bodhicitta, who has a working definition they could offer for the bodhicitta right now? Even the stock phrase that we say in the puja.
Isn't that the will to enlightenment?
Yeah. It's the will to enlightenment for
for
the benefit of all beings. So it is that will, it's that turning about, it's the kind of getting into the stream of the Dharma, it's going for refuge, but there's definitely a very compassionate side to it. So you're doing it not just for yourself, but for the whole situation that you're in. You know, you're doing it for everybody. Yeah, so it's a very compassionate sort of ideal. And the main practice in the 7-point mind training is one called Tonglen, which is taking and receiving. And you basically what you're doing, I think Natalie's going to talk more about this, so I'm not going to talk a little bit about it. Yeah? She's going to talk a little bit about it too. So between a little bit now and a little bit then, it'll fill you in. The Tonglen practice, I think of it as quite basic ethics, to be honest, but visualized. So what you're doing is you are kind of imagining that the ailments of the world, that you're breathing them in with your in-breath, yeah, and that they're getting purified. And then as you breathe out, you're breathing out a white light, a pure white light, just purifying the world. So I kind of see it as taking on the difficulties of the world and being a tendency of change and amelioration and good in the world. The problem with the practice, I think it's very similar to a metta-bhavana-style practice, but this is my mind too. I like to synthesize things and make them the same and try and find the things that equate. So I'm sure people could argue against me very easily. But I think of it as a metta-bhavana-style practice, and I think of it as slightly as very ethical, because it's sort of like when things happen that are difficult around you, you know, instead of seeing them as instead of taking them personally, I think you see them as kind of things that are, you know, kind of situations where there's suffering present. And you sort of allow that suffering and you let that suffering in. And what you try and do in return is instead of contribute to the suffering, you try and contribute to the cure. So then you try and breathe out and bring into that situation, you know, goodness, you know, kind of kindness, generosity, courage, confidence, determination, joy, whatever you can. So the thing about... The thing about the Tonglen practice, yeah, I guess so. The thing about the Tonglen practice is that it's also not something that you can do by yourself as an individual. It's something that has to be done by something bigger. So a lot of times, you know, it seems to be a very important point that you don't take that practice in the wrong way as something that you're doing as you, in a way. You know, there's other people doing it with you. So you could even think of it as something that's done communally or something that's done almost cosmically. So that's the main practice, training the bodhicitta. There's about 9 different points on ultimate bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta, and I just thought, no way. So I didn't present them. But you can look at them if you want. Ultimate bodhicitta is regard all phenomena as dreams, investigate the nature of unborn awareness, even the antidote is released in its ground, rest within the all basis, the essential nature, and then post meditation, regard all beings as illusions. So it's pretty heavy stuff. But the relative bodhicitta is more practical, and that's that practice of Tonglen I was just talking about. So after the training in the bodhicitta, the third category is transforming adverse conditions. And the fourth one is saturating your life. With your practice. The fifth one is evaluating your practice. And then after that comes some basics. There's a whole bunch of what are just called commitments. There's 16 of them. And then there's a whole bunch of guidelines. And there's 21 of them. So those are the 7 main points. And I think once you get beyond the kind of the training in bodhicitta, it's basically the next 3 are probably the bulk of the practice. So transforming adverse conditions is very kind of basic to the whole thing of Tonglen. You know, it's this whole idea of actually transforming your life in a way. And saturating your life with practice is that kind of maybe that reaching out, but definitely putting your practice into your life and then having some sense of how to evaluate your practice. And then the other 2 are sort of more general. So that's kind of that. I don't know. That's my introduction to the 7-point mind training. I wanna end here because I just like to have at least a couple minutes for questions, maybe 5 or 10 minutes. But I'd invite you to do consider coming back next week because you know, and hearing people talk individually about kind of what they pull out of this. And I promise next week I will make a printout of the 59 points and have one available for everybody.